Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting live and video streaming from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, on the Progressive Commentary Hour, a single theme examined from many different points of view. The theme, the military legacy of President Barack Obama and the expansion of the American Empire. My guest during our program will be Ray McGovern, who served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George W. Bush. Among his duties were preparing the president's daily briefing, which he briefed one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. Since retiring from government service, he has been one of our nation's most vocal peace activists and journalists. As an act of conscience, in 2006, Ray returned to the Intelligence Commendation Medallion given him at retirement from, quote, especially meritorious service. In 2003, he helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify our war in Iraq. Ray's opinion pieces appear in many leading newspapers here and abroad, including a major section of an important book, Neocon Again, Dealing with America's War in Iraq. He holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham Graduate School and Harvard Business School and Georgetown University. His website is raymcgovern.com. Also joining us today is Professor David Vine. Professor Vine is a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. He is the author of Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia, Princeton Press, and that focuses on U.S. foreign and military police, policy, military bases, forced displacement, and human rights. He is the co-author with the Network for Concerned Anthropologists and of the Counterinsurgency Manual, or Notes on Demilitarization of America. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, Mother Jones, among others. His current research is an investigation into the global network of U.S. military bases overseas. His latest article, appearing in Tom Dispatch, is one of the most important articles, according to Tom Dispatch editor Tom Englehart, to have appeared this year. Again, the book is Island of Shame, website davidvine.net. Nice to have you with us today, both of you gentlemen.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Gary.
Before we begin our in-depth discussions, and just so people understand, because I do 15 hours of live broadcasting a week, and this is the most downloaded show in all of non-commercial radio, and I haven't compared it to commercial radio, but I'm sure it would be right up there, and it's a thought-provoking show. And instead of a chit-chat back and forth, I prefer to lay out an extended overview, taking 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes if necessary, so that people really understand the context, what we're going to discuss, and then turn it over to the guest uninterrupted for them to have a forum, a classroom on the air, to take this piece by piece, unhurried, and really give us the story that we need. And then we conclude with a dialogue where everyone has a chance to share with one another. Near the end of the program, time permit, we'll even take some calls. So that's our forum today. Now, that said, why am I doing this program? I'm doing this program because I find it a little disingenuous that we have a president who won the Nobel Peace Prize and at the same time has been one of the most aggressive and assertive militarizing presidents in U.S. history. He is also a leader in secrecy and classification of documents. He has gone after whistleblowers in all areas of government. And at the same time, as he has had Bradley Manning arrested for allegedly taking documents and giving them to WikiLeaks, including the infamous video that showed Blackwater mercenaries killing some unarmed civilians, he has done nothing about the FDA that has hacked 80,000 emails and has illegally spied on its own scientists on their own private computers, even with conversations between those individuals and their attorneys, whistleblowers and their attorneys, whistleblowers and the advocate in the FDA, all of which are felonies. So on the one hand, if you spy or if you leak classified documents, if you're doing it on behalf of the political agenda of this administration, there is no problem. If you report on crimes against humanity that embarrasses this administration or any other, then you've got a big problem. So it's just this hypocrisy that I'm concerned with. Now, that said, I want to go through some of the legacy of President Obama. He signed the National Defense Authorization Act permitting assassination of U.S. citizens without trial. He signed extension of the Patriot Act without reform. Our involvement in overthrowing Gaddafi without congressional approval. Are now doing the same in Syria, yet CIA supporting the militant opposition, but trying to work through NATO. And at the same time, as we're now seeing, some members of the left, including on some Pacifica stations, some popular programs, suggesting that it's all about one side in Syria and not acknowledging the role that the CIA and other clandestine operations are playing in the overthrow of the Syrian government. Started a secret drone war in Yemen, escalated the CIA drone war in Pakistan, escalated the proxy war in Somalia, escalated troops in our conflicts in Afghanistan. Also, per an article by Jeremy Scahill, Obama has secretly deployed U.S. special forces in 75 countries, recently beefing up our military presence in the Persian Gulf to threaten Iran, sold $60 billion of weapons of serious nature to Saudi dictatorship, the largest overseas deal in history, signed agreements for 7 more military bases in Colombia, new bases in Honduras, continues to tout nuclear power, allocating nearly $8 billion this year just to maintain and increase our military arsenal, and which are, we have to understand, all of our nuclear scientists know that we can convert our nuclear power to weapon development, declared South Sudan eligible to receive weapons and defense assistance from the U.S., opposition to Palestinian statehood, and I wished he could watch, as I did late last night, an Al Jazeera documentary, very objective, very fair. It's simply focused on one thing. What does it mean to be an average citizen in the Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza, and try to go through their country, through a checkpoint, into Israel, whether you need an emergency medicine or anything, even a little kid going to school in a refugee camp, the 3 hours that it took just at the gate, frequently being rejected, and what it means to live in such a condition, yet Obama has never acknowledged this. Failure to call an end to Israel's siege of Gaza, opposes return of a legitimate president of Haiti, Jean-Bernard Aristide, expansion of the anti-terrorist laws to target even peace and environmental activists, supporting dictatorships to expand U.S. presence to encircle Russia, and now the menace towards China. Those are my issues of why I chose to do this program. Now, that said, now our short comments from each of you, please. Take any part of what I just discussed about this president, and I ask you this, and if you could give me a relatively straightforward answer on this, then we'll go into our in-depth discussions. I'll start with you, Ray McGovern. Why is it the American media has refused to really go into depth and do original investigations, as you have and as Dr. Vine have, on any of the issues I just discussed?
I think it has to do with who runs the media and for what purpose. If you look at the ownership of the main video, the main channels and the broadcast stations, you'll find that many of those corporations are the ones that benefit from profiteering. I don't say profiting, but profiteering on the wars that are generated abroad. That's very clear, and it's abundantly clear before the war on Iraq, when each one of these stations were cheerleading for the war, and those like Donahue were fired if they had people representing other viewpoints. The same thing is happening now with the same people with respect to Iran. Iran poses no danger at all to our country, and yet we have an artificial stoking of hate and fear against a country that has no nuclear weapons and that the intelligence community insists has not yet decided whether to reverse its decision of 2003 when it decided to stop working on a nuclear weapon. So the media in general, I'm thinking TV especially, because that's where most people get their news, is hardly objective, and the reasons are pretty clear. They don't serve the purpose of informing the American people. They serve different purposes, many of them commercial. A little footnote here. You mentioned Bradley Manning. Well, the dire situation that I just described, where it's very difficult to get accurate information, and it has been for several decades now, that's the old Fourth Estate, and I would suggest that the Fourth Estate is moribund. The good news is that there's a Fifth Estate. The Fifth Estate is out in the ether. It's not easily controlled by governments, although people like the Chinese and others do try to control it. I'm talking about the Internet, the web, and that's where people like Bradley Manning, who is a true patriot, who saw the kinds of abuses that were happening in Iraq to people his age, people thrown into prison where they're tortured, his own colleagues torturing people and shooting them from the air. And what Bradley Manning decided to do was in the best tradition of our ethos here, having to do with journalism. And what he said to his email correspondent was this: okay, I've released these items. God knows what's going to happen now. Hopefully, worldwide discussion, debate, and reforms. I want people to see the truth, because without information, you cannot make informed decisions as a public. End quote. Well, that's what Thomas Jefferson said. That's what everyone said who's interested in preserving our democracy. Without accurate knowledge, you cannot have a democracy. And so that's why it's so important that stations like yours and publications like Consortium News, for which I write, and Tom Dispatch, of course, is one of the eminent ones, that they put the word out. And the trick seems to me, or the challenge seems to me, to make it easy for the American public at large, even people my age, to realize that all they have to do is push two buttons, let's say, or maybe three, and treat themselves to unadulterated, truthful information with the computer. And that seems to be not a chasm that has been bridged yet. And once it is, I think the American people have a fair chance of learning what's going on and stopping the abuses, of which there are many.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. We'll come back to you in a few moments. I'm going to have some specific questions for you concerning Iran and the likelihood of war there and the militarization of the entire area and changing the geopolitical landscape to support Israel and our efforts there. That in a few moments. Now over to you, Professor Vine. Here's my question for you to introduce this discussion. For the last 10 years, Japan and then China became the two largest contributors to cash for debt in the United States. Quite simply, we would not have been able to have gone on these excursions without them giving us their cash, and we give them our T-bills. China has had the fastest growing and the greatest impact in economy, growth economy, in the last 10 years. It's slowing now. Now, since they have been our partner and we've been importing their cheaply made products to sell in our malls and Walmarts, and since they're holding originally almost $2 trillion, about $1.8 trillion of our debt, how reasonable is it then to start posturing with military exercises in the South Pacific, building up the South Pacific fleets, putting forces in Australia and New Zealand and other countries, and then to give the impression that we're concerned about China's might when China's total military industrial complex budget is not 1/100th of ours. Ours is more than all the other world combined twice over, as if they're trying to start intentionally, the neocons, a new Cold War with China and Russia. What is the likely outcome of that? If China decides enough of this, we don't have to have a war with you, we'll just stop giving you our money, and we will unload the debt, Your T-bills, which they've already done substantially, very few people are aware of that, by building 17 phantom cities with 65 million housing units, plus a lot of other things. And suddenly we get them so angry at us that they simply say, that's it. What is the outcome of our current policy under this president and the military advisors around them concerning China?
It's a very good and complicated question, of course, and I, of course, also don't know the outcome, but I do think it's a very dangerous strategy and dangerous relationship that's developing. I think clearly the United States and China are deeply intertwined and interconnected economically and otherwise. If China suddenly decided to stop lending us money, of course, that would cause grievous damage to the U.S. economy, which in turn would cause grievous damage to the Chinese economy because we would no longer be able to buy the things that their factories produce. So it's unlikely, at least looking today, that China would do that. Of course, we can't know in the future under other circumstances. Perhaps China would stop lending us money. Perhaps they would cut off the supply of cash that has kept our wars and our government going. So we of course don't know how that's going to play out in the future. But I am quite concerned about current U.S. military strategy when it comes to China and Russia. I think you're absolutely right in pointing to what would appear to be growing cold wars with both countries, and I feel like the U.S. is playing a major role in fueling both. I think bases in particular are playing very important roles in fueling these growing cold wars. Over the past decade or so, the United States has been building more and more bases on the doorstep of both Russia and China. In Russia's case, in Central Asia and increasingly in Central and Eastern Europe. In China's case, as you mentioned, the creation of a new joint base in Darwin, Australia, and the investigation or planning for other bases, perhaps in Perth and Brisbane, and also on the Cocos Island, part of Australia, while the U.S. also is in the process of establishing bases in Singapore, appears to be trying to return to the Philippines, and actually has been in the Philippines since the attacks of 9/11 with as many as 600 troops there, while exploring the creation of other bases throughout Southeast Asia and elsewhere in East Asia more broadly. And this, of course, is on top of a infrastructure long established in Asia of bases that the United States has maintained since the end of World War II and the Korean War, so mostly in Japan, South Korea, and Guam, but elsewhere, a network of bases that before the Bush administration was already numbered more than 200. So we already have a very significant military infrastructure in East Asia, and now people in the Pentagon and elsewhere are saying that we need to increase that military presence even more. I think we need to think about, in both the case of China and Russia, how the United States would be likely to respond, how U.S. citizens would respond if either country, or Iran for that matter, were to create even a single base on our doorstep, a single base in the Caribbean or Mexico. My fear is that, of course, as we might expect, China and Russia will respond to these U.S. moves to build bases, increase our military presence in areas surrounding their countries by only boosting their own military spending and their own, in some cases perhaps, even their own creation of bases outside their own territory. I fear that there might be something of a base race brewing. So what I foresee is something of a spiraling process of militarization where, much like we saw in the Cold War, and the effects of which we can't know, but that could be extraordinarily dangerous and could make wars with either nation, not just cold wars, but hot wars, more likely rather than less.
I appreciate those insights, Professor Vine. When we come back to you after speaking with Ray McGovern, I'm going to ask you about the 1,000-plus military bases that we have around the world, the $1.4 trillion on-book, off-book, all monies for the national defense, national security state, and why both Obama and the Democrats and the Republicans and Romney want to increase this instead of decreasing it, and how much we actually need to be safe. I have some statistics on that, and it's shocking. And what happens if we allow this mindset to go into this election cycle without being officially rebuked by both the progressive conservative and progressive liberal apparatus that's out there, not the official corporatized. So what does that mean if we don't decrease it, we increase it? So I'm going to ask you that question when we come back, all right?
Sounds good.
Good. Let's go back over to Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern, I have one larger question. Please take your time and look at it from all possible perspectives, because it's a thought-provoking question. On the one hand, many believe that George Bush engaged in a military coup. Now, not the coup we're used to, but rather a coup took place in the United States where the military and the military-industrial complex and the intelligence complexes and the security agencies and the politicians and lobbyists and the corporatists all got a piece of the action if they continue to keep Americans fearful. Then they all benefited. And then Obama has continued that extension and has instituted a foreign and domestic policy with the same rhetoric that began earlier in Vietnam, winning hearts and minds through military ventures. Iraq, he promised to withdraw troops from Iraq, but he did not. What he did is he withdrew the uniformed troops, but he increased private security contractors at $1,200 a day by tens of thousands. And the State Department, another 12,000. All of these are mercenaries. And the CIA, a substantial presence. So we really haven't shifted. We still have over 60,000 people in Iraq who are capable of being a part of that country's continuing legacy. In Afghanistan, when Obama came to office, there were 30,000 troops. Now there are 90,000. And we've had double the number of American deaths in Afghanistan after Bush. In the Pacific theater, although Obama and Hillary have been criticized on the right for some budget cutbacks in the military, he's receiving wide applause from the hawks and neocons in both parties for increasing military presence in the Pacific, as Professor Vine just stated, not just in Australia, but also in the Philippines, in places that they're reintroducing bases that have been closed for a long time, including in Thailand and now wanting to be in Vietnam, if that isn't an irony. So here's my question for you. I believe it is inevitable at this moment that Israel intends, for its own purposes, having nothing realistically to do with its future security, actually I believe it would be creating an insecure situation, to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. And in the process, they cannot attack their nuclear facilities without attacking their entire military infrastructure. In the process doing that, they must have the tacit approval of NATO and the backing of the United States. And doing that, it is inevitable that Russia, China, India are going to come together in support of Iran. Then that will fracture the Middle East. It will also cause a substantial challenge to Saudi Arabia, because Iran's not about to let Saudi Arabia go unchallenged, since it is very vulnerable, even with all of its military hardware, to its own oil fields being attacked, plus all of the stoppage of oil coming out through the Straits of Hormuz, and also what could cause the price of oil to go from $200 to $300 a barrel and gasoline to go to $10 to $15 a gallon, and what that would do to airplane flight, truck flight, transportation, getting to and from work, fuel in the wintertime. The consequences could be substantial, yet that is not being discussed at all. It's just everything for Israel, and we have the Israeli lobbyist backed by the Mossad telling us we must do this. And you already see the New York Times, you see all these people suggesting in the media we must stop the nuclear threat. The talking heads are all over television. Tell us now, uninterrupted, what you believe is the likely outcome, and do you believe this is an outcome? Do you believe it'll happen or not happen? What would happen, knowing your background in analysis of intelligence data, if it does? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Thank you, Gary. Well, first off, there are differences as well as similarities to U.S. policy and its approach to the problem of Iraq on the one hand and the problem of Iran on the other. With respect to Iraq, and in answer to some of your points, it was Dick Cheney who pretty much subverted the normal bureaucratic functioning of government and forced his will both first on George Bush and then on others, especially the military, and we had the war in Iraq. We had intelligence playing a very, very disreputable role in that, because intelligence was not mistaken. Please don't buy that. Intelligence was fraudulent. It was cooked up with the eager cooperation of the head of the CIA, George Tenet, who served up fraudulent intelligence. That's because Bush and Cheney wanted to make war on Iraq. They wanted to do that, number one, because it's a very rich area in oil and natural gas. Number two, it's a big strategic area. They felt the need to have a big U.S. presence there. And number three, and please don't laugh at this one, they thought that that would make that part of the world more secure, more safe for the state of Israel. There didn't used to be suicide bombers in Iraq, and as you probably know, 98 people were killed just yesterday in Iraq, so it's hardly pacified. So whether it's a lesser danger to Israel, I suppose you could say with Saddam Hussein gone and the country in shambles, I suppose it's a sort of a lesser threat. The situation now is different. With respect to Iran, the military and the intelligence people, the military do not want to get involved in a war with Iran. Matter of fact, one of the few four-star, he happened to be an admiral, who actually took a position on this and got fired for it, was Admiral Flip Fallon, who said, and he said this to a colleague of mine, "We're not going to do Iran on my watch." That's when he was head of CENTCOM, the operational command there in that part of the world. My friend, Pat Lang, said, "Admiral, may I share that?" And Fallon looked at him and didn't say anything. So the next day, it appeared on the front page of the Washington Post. Admiral Fallon says, "We're not going to do Iran on my watch." That's what he wanted to appear there, because it would be sheer lunacy to attack Iran. Admiral Mullen, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he went over to Israel several times saying, "Please, don't do this. It's not a good idea. And by the way, don't even try the kind of provocation that we know you Israelis are good at." And you know what Mullen did? For the first and only time that I'm aware of, he referred with Israeli officials to the USS Liberty incident, where on the 8th of June, 1967, during the Six-Day War, the Israelis deliberately attacked the USS Liberty, killed 34 of our sailors, wounded 172. LBJ and McNamara, Congress, and the U.S. Navy all covered that episode up. The reason I mention that is Mullen wanted the Israelis to take him seriously, okay? And he said, "Look, we don't want a war on Iran. Don't try to start it. And if you try to start it in the same subterfuge way as you used in the USS Liberty, well, remember, I'm a naval officer. I know about that. And we're not going to tolerate it." Okay? Now, the saving grace on the plans that Cheney and Bush had, and the Israelis, of course, at the core of this, to attack Iran was, and I'm very happy to announce this, honest people in my part of the CIA, the assessments part, the intelligence analysis part, who came in after the debacle of Iraq, where, as I said before, the intelligence was corrupted. They came in and they said, "Oh, looks like Iran is next in the sights of Israel and its neocon supporters here in this country. Let's do an assessment, an honest one, on how close they are to a nuclear weapon." Well, We had been saying ever since 1992 that Iran was about 5 years away from a nuclear weapon. 97, we said, oh, about 5 years. Year 2000, we said, Iran's probably about 5 years away from nuclear. Well, Tom Finger, who took over the assessments function, said, this is garbage. We want a bottom-up assessment. And guess what they found out? They found out, working during the entire year of 2007, that Iran had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003, and they assessed that unanimously, all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, end quote, with high confidence, end quote. They further reported that there was no information that Iran had reconstituted or had begun again working on a weapon system. Now, that was a shocker. And if you read George Bush's memoir, Decision Points, and this is almost ludicrous because he appears to have written this page himself, he said, this was a bombshell. I don't know why the intelligence community would say such a thing. I mean, hello, could it be because it was the truth? And then he has this paragraph, and I quote it. After that national intelligence estimate, how could I possibly authorize a military strike on the nuclear facilities of a country that the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program? End quote. Well, bummer. So, long story short, an accurate, an honest, gutsy estimate took everyone by surprise, but it became public and played a huge role in stopping a war. Now, what's happened since then? That was the end of 2007, saying that the Iranians had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003, 4 years before. Now we're 5 years after the fact. Every year since, the head of national intelligence has testified to Congress that there is no good intelligence that Iran has decided to resume work on a nuclear weapon. On the 8th of January, our defense secretary, Panetta, sort of out of nowhere with Bob Schieffer on Face the Nation, he said, is Iran working on a nuclear weapon? No. 10 days later, Ehud Barak, Panetta's counterpart in the Israeli government, the defense secretary, he said, we agree with the American assessment. And when the radio interviewer said, well, okay, suppose they do decide to do a nuclear weapon, how soon could they get one? And Ehud Barak said, and I have the official government translation here, he said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because to do that, they would have to throw out the UN inspectors, and that's precisely why they are very reluctant to throw out the nuclear inspectors. Without throwing them out, we would learn right away, and that would be a new situation. So both defense secretaries acknowledge that Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon. The UN inspection agency, the IAEA, has never found an ounce of diversion from the low-enriched uranium to the more highly enriched uranium. And so what's all this business about? Well, it's about Israel and its intention, if it can succeed, in giving Iran a very big bloody nose before the election in our country in November. Now, how does that work? Well, Netanyahu, and for those of you who saw him on TV yesterday, see what a clever actor he is. The Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has really taken the measure of our president when President Obama said, doing settlements in occupied territories is illegal. Netanyahu put his thumb on his nose and waved his fingers in a way to say, well, make me stop. And he authorized more and more and more settlements. So he's creating facts on the ground where the West Bank will never be able to be a separate Palestinian state. So the point here is that Netanyahu has taken the measure of our president, and he's found him, well, let's say, His view is that Obama needs a spine implant, okay? And that Netanyahu enjoys more popularity with the United States Congress than Obama does, and that were Netanyahu to start a dust-up with Iran, Obama would have no political alternative but to jump in with both feet. Now, that scares our military to death, and it also is ajar or jars the intelligence analysts who say that, contrary to what you're hearing from the Israelis, Iran poses no threat at all to our country. Matter of fact, I have a quote from Hillary Clinton saying that 2 years ago in Doha. And so what's this big ruckus? Well, the big ruckus is twofold. One is the Israelis would dearly love to have, quote, regime change, end quote, in Tehran. What does that mean? Well, in my day, we used to call it overthrowing governments. And most people will remember that in 1953, that's precisely what we did in Tehran, overthrow a duly elected, the first ever Persian democratically elected prime minister, Mossadegh. We overthrew him. Why? Well, because he got this crazy notion that more of the oil wealth that was beneath the sands of Iran should be shared with the Iranian people and not all go to BP and U.S. oil interests. So they overthrew him. The Iranians know that. That's part of history. They remember that. So what we're dealing with here is a kind of incentive that the Israelis have to do what they can to get regime change in Iran, not because Iran is a big threat to them, but just to get them out of the rivalry that exists now, because Iran, after all, is the only real rival to Israel in that part of the world. The other thing is that by stoking the fires of this, quote, end quote, of the Iranian nuclear weapon, the Israelis have successfully diverted attention from the real problem in the Middle East, and that is the Palestinian issue. The fact that 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes in 1948, many of them would like to return. The Palestinians have a miserable existence on the West Bank, in Gaza, and in Israel proper. So the attention has been successfully diverted from that, and in the meantime, Israel is, as they say, building facts on the ground by creating more settlements. So the bottom line here is that in this interregnum period, when Obama is running against Romney for president, it could be that Netanyahu would say, well, you know, this is our best chance. I am convinced 90%, and that's enough for me, says Netanyahu, that if we start a dust-up, and we can easily do that with the ships that are, you know, chock-full in the Persian Gulf, if we start a dust-up with the Iranians, Obama will have to come to our aid because of electoral politics as he sees them in our country. Now, if there's a sharp rise in oil prices, and Obama is running for president, that's not going to be really good for him. And we, says Netanyahu, we would very much prefer to have my friend Romney as president rather than a president who's in his second term and has to be less susceptible to the kinds of pressures that are exerted on any president by the Israel lobby. That's what they're afraid of. When Carter was running for re-election, the Israelis did everything they could to prevent him from being re-elected because they had sort of promised him that once the peace accord with Egypt and later with Jordan were achieved, then the Israelis would do something on the Palestinian issue. And so they worked very hard to get Reagan elected rather than Jimmy Carter. So it's the same thing now. They would like to see Romney elected because they fear a second-term president who knows, maybe Obama does have a sense of decency and would go to Palestine and see the conditions there. That's always a risk, and the Israelis don't want that. So between now and November, you can expect Netanyahu and his cabinet to be puzzling through what's the best thing for them to do. And I'm sorry to say that I agree with you, Gary, that the chances are increasing that there will be a battle or some war in that part of the country. And the recent terrorist incident in Bulgaria, where Netanyahu immediately blamed Iran, and there's no real evidence. On TV yesterday, he said, well, trust me, we have the great security system, so just trust me. Well, he's already stoking the fires. And then there's a little bit of evidence that the British intelligence people are starting to trim their sails and suggesting that Iran might get a bomb within 2 years. So the intelligence, too, might be corrupted this time. I hope not by our people. But it's a very, very volatile situation. Just to say, as I have said many times, that there's a 50% chance of a major war involving Iran in that part of the world is a horrendous thing for anyone who knows about that part of the world, knows about the oil, knows about the Iranians, and knows about what kind of morass we would become involved in were we to do that.
Okay, I appreciate those oversights. I just have a few follow-up questions for you before I go back to Professor Vine. Dick Cheney created his own unique intelligence agency unofficially inside the White House that was overseen by Scooter Litte. This we know. They selected the curveball, the so-called expert Iraqi, who was the source of Judith Miller's, we've got an informer who says they are creating weapons of mass destruction. The CIA knew at the time, as did the Germans, as did the Mossad, that he had no credibility. And yet, it was through the White House, not through the CIA, that that information was leaked to Judith Miller. They've never been held accountable for that. It was always made to look like the CIA screwed up. The CIA never screwed up on that. The actual rank-and-file people inside the CIA had it right, but who knew that Cheney was running his own CIA to control the intelligence they wanted, and they did it right up through Colin Powell's final coup de grace speech that caused us to go forward. That said, I believe that we're going to see the same thing. I believe Bill O'Reilly and all the people, the neocons on the left, and those who are also like Chuck Scarborough and those on the left will start lining up about the threat of Iran, and I believe there may be a false flag operation. And after all, Israel has engaged in several false flag operations as a matter of historical fact, as did, by the way, the United States with the Gulf of Tonkin episode, for example, something you would have known about because you were at that time in a position of power to know all the dirty tricks going on. That said, let's just look at a few qualities. When we invaded Iraq, we had substantially neutralized and knew that it would only be a matter of weeks until we did the dust up, that Iraq would be defeated. Saddam Hussein had real no military power to fight back with, and we knew it. And we're now looking at who did Saddam Hussein had as an ally. He was alone. He had already isolated the Saudis. He was isolated the Kuwaitis, and he had been a mortal enemy of Iran. So outside of a few supporters, he had real no support base. Now let's take a look at the scenario today. First, Iran geographically is 2.5 times larger than Iraq. It has one of the largest standing militaries in there, and they have been trained for urban and guerrilla warfare. They have Hamas and Hezbollah. They have groups everywhere. They also have Gee Whiz. Who's one of their largest supporters if there's a conflict? Iraq, which is Sunni, a Shia, their Shia, and Muqtada Sadr, who has been studying to be an imam to take his father's place, who was killed by, we thought, Saddam Hussein. Now it turns out it might have been Gaddafi. And so they're going to align themselves, especially the hard right Shia. He will also be in alignment with some of the other nations, including India, China, and Russia. Well, what exactly then does that mean when it comes to us borrowing money from these countries, doing trade with these countries, if in fact we have a de facto war? None of that is going to continue unchallenged. And here's a scenario, merely a subjective scenario on my part, and it's merely a hypothesis, and I claim no more credibility for it than a working hypothesis. But I hypothesize that China has looked at this scenario and realizes it does not have to go to war. It would be counterproductive to go to war. Instead, it has been quietly realizing that the money it has given the United States, as has Japan, as has many other nations, if it stops giving it and if it stops its trade, think of the consequences in the United States. It still has trading partners throughout the world and its own internal situation. Also, it's been selling off its T-bills. How do you think they built 17 of the world's largest cities in the interior of China, 65 million units, beautiful metropolises that no one lives in? At the same time, Japan is now faced with the highly probable situation of having to relocate anywhere from 20 to 60 million of its inhabitants because of the Fukushima radiation that continues. And I've been on this, did a documentary on it, Knocking on the Devil's Door, Deadly Nuclear Legacy. And we brought in the Ralph Nader of Japan. We brought in experts to talk at the Ethical Culture Center, at the premiere of the film, who said they're lying about everything. It's far worse than what it is. Well, we just found out yesterday that they were hiding, putting lead shields around the Geiger counters and the radiation detection devices so that even though people were exposed to very high, even lethal doses of radiation, the workup, they were supposed to disguise the readings so they could say, oh, it's not that bad. Now, we know that there's one remaining reactor, one remaining. If that fails, and if the cooling rods in that reactor at Fukushima, if for an earthquake or something caused that to destroy, Japan is toast. It is gone. Every expert I've spoken to in the world suggests that. Now we know that Japan is working with Russia and trying to reclaim an island taken away from Japan at the end of the Second World War to rehabitate it and reindustrialize it. We know that two other islands off Japan that Japan owns are being fast, with heavy money and at breakneck speed, are reindustrializing. And we know that China has been meeting with Japanese officials to determine, is it possible to habitate some of these cities, since it would be a uniquely and exclusive Japanese population, and then keep the heavy work and commercial part of Japan to the safer areas of the island, so if it ever had to happen, then they have a place to be. So there are options available. That means there would be a working relationship between Japan and China that would now mean that the United States would have two allies working together instead of splitting them. It also means that they control the dollar. Now, I happen to know from someone very close to me who is very high up in finance, one of the highest members of the financial community in the world. This man knows everything going on. And he told me, and I'll share this confidence with you, because I said I was going to. He said, fine. That China has been offloading our dollars quietly by building and buying and purchasing rare metals around the world. It now controls between 83 and 90% of most rare metals that we need. Buying land for growing its crops to feed its population. Building factories around the world. Leasing property. And also building these cities. So one said, this man said, Gary, if you think that the Chinese are sitting there holding $1.78 trillion, forget about it. They'd be lucky to have $500 billion at this point, but that's true also of other countries. They're unloading dollars like crazy, but doing it quietly so it doesn't crash. So now the dollar is the reserve currency. What happens, Ray McGovern, if we do allow Israel to invade, and then we have to support them, and China decides, along with Russia, along with the BRIC nations, Brazil, which would go along with them, and India, to get rid of the dollar as a reserve currency, go to their own mixed currencies, and now the dollar free falls. Now you got a free-falling dollar, you got a hyperinflation, you got a hyperdeflation, because what you buy is going to be worth a lot less than what it's going to cost to buy anything. It's going to be a lot more. And at the same time, you now become the pariah of the world. You got 22 Arab League nations. Only 17 of those are going to side with Iran in this conflict. You now have a split Iran. You have a strong democratic movement, but they're still, at the end of the day, they're still Iranian. And if you bomb that country, you're going to have civilian casualties. Now you're going to unite them. And much like when we undid Mossadegh, the second part of the statement was, yes, we got rid of them. That was because the British and British Petroleum convinced Eisenhower through their British intelligence that it was a security risk not to. But we forgot that we put the Shah of Iran for 26 years in their place, and he became one of the most demented and vicious absolutely homicidal maniacs in history, a preening peacock, but he killed people, had one of the most lethal corrupt secret services, and they captured, tortured, and disappeared or killed dissidents, all with our full knowledge and support. So now what's going to happen with the Arab League nations, with the major BRIC nations, with the value of the currency? And that's even before you start limiting oil. Those are some thoughts I have that I consider important enough that we should at least discuss them. Over to you.
Well, Gary, I wish that you had a position with the National Security Council, because the things you're talking about are absent from discussion there, as far as I can tell. There's an old expression, I think it comes from the Bible, without vision, the people perish. Well, there is no vision with respect to our foreign policy. Our foreign policy is still based on the time when we first became the sole remaining superpower in the world. And that was not, you know, when the Soviet Union imploded. It was in 1945, when we survived that war in a way that no one else did. And what was the policy as set down? The very first Policy Planning Council paper said this: we have 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task in the coming period is to maintain this position of disparity. And to do that, we're going to have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming. We can't deceive ourselves that we can afford the luxury of altruism. We should cease to talk about vague, unreal objectives like human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we will have to deal in straight power concepts. Now, that's George Kennan, who used to be an idol of mine, my specialization being Russian history. But that was the hardcore, hard power guidelines set down as early as 1948, which is the date of this statement. So, again, we're 50% of the world's wealth. Well, maybe we only have 45% now, but we're even less than 6.3% of its population, and therein lies the problem. We have to learn what my grandchildren in nursery school learn, and that is, they need to learn to share things. Americans need to know that they can't work their will on the world in the same way that they were able to do in the immediate post-World War II world. Now, China and Russia, when I was an analyst and that was my portfolio, they were at loggerheads. They hated each other. They did everything they could to curry favor with us in that triangular relationship. Now they're sitting back laughing at us, how overextended we are for all the reasons that you mentioned. So without the vision that's necessary, without these questions being able to come up and being asked, I have real fear that we'll just drift past this next election, and hopefully maybe Obama will get some better advisors and learn something more about the world and disengage from the things that are stupid and engage in places like China, because there is no inevitable antipathy between us and China. We need to deal with them in a respectful way and not surround them with bases which are not going to work.
I appreciate those insights, Ray McGovern. We're coming up to this end of the segment of our program, but I am continuing this. So we are going to take a brief station break, and for those who are listening over the internet, continue to listen. We will be back in 30 seconds, and we will continue on, because we still have to have an entire dialogue with Professor David Vine, and then I'm going to ask both gentlemen to respond to a commentary from Chris Hedges from truthdig.com called The Careerist, which gives us a better understanding on how we can have so many people engaged at so many levels of federal bureaucracies and corporate bureaucracies who do not challenge the lack of vision in the choices we make. I'm Gary Null. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour, our discussion, the military legacy of President Barack Obama and the expansion of the American empire. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you. If you're just joining us, I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. We welcome you. My panel today, Ray McGovern, served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. And he prepared the President's Daily Briefing, which was given to the one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. And he is at raymcgovern.com and consortiumnews.com. Also, Professor David Vine, professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., is the author of Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base at Iago Garcia. And he is at Island of Shame, the book, and davidvine.net. Now, Professor Vine, over to you. I'm going to start our discussion in this segment by quoting your article, if I may, a few paragraphs, please. All right?
Sounds great.
The Lily Pad Strategy, How the Pentagon is Quietly Transforming Its Overseas Base Empire and Creating a Dangerous New Way of War, by David Vine. I'll quote, "The first thing I saw last month when I walked into the belly of a dark gray C-17 Air Force cargo plane was a void. Something missing. A missing left arm, to be exact, severed at the shoulder, temporarily patched and held together. Thick, pale flesh, flecked with bright red at the edges. It looked like meat sliced open. The face and what remained of the rest of the man was obscured by blankets, an American flag quilt, and a jumble of tubes and tapes, wires, drip bags, and medical monitors. That man and two other critically wounded soldiers, one with two stumps where legs had been, the other missing a leg below the thigh, were intubated, unconscious, and lying on stretchers hooked to the walls of the plane that just landed at Ranstein Air Base in Germany. A tattoo on the soldier's remaining arm read, Death Before Dishonor. I asked the member of the Air Force medical team about the casualties they see like this. Many, as with this flight, were coming from Afghanistan. He told me, a lot from the Horn of Africa. He added, you don't really hear about that in the media. Where in Africa? I asked. He said he didn't know exactly, but generally from the Horn, often with critical injuries, a lot of it out of that area. Since the Black Hawk down deaths in Somalia almost 20 years ago, we've heard little, if anything, about American military casualties in Africa, other than a strange report last week about three special operations commandos killed, along with three women identified by U.S. military sources as Moroccan prostitutes, in a mysterious car accident in Mali. The growing number of patients arriving at the hospital from Africa pulls back a curtain on a significant transformation in 21st century U.S. military strategy. These casualties are likely to be the vanguard of a growing number of wounded troops coming from places far removed from Afghanistan or Iraq. They reflect the increased use of relatively small bases like Camp Lemonnier, which military planners see as a model for future U.S. bases scattered, as one academic explains, across regions in which the United States has previously not maintained a military presence. Disappearing are the days when Ramstein was the signature U.S. base, an American town-sized bemoaneth filled with thousands or tens of thousands of American PXs, Pizza Huts, and other amenities of home. But don't for a second think that the Pentagon is packing up, downsizing its global mission, and heading home. In fact, based upon developments in recent years, the opposite may be true. While the collection of Cold War-era giant bases around the world is shrinking, the global infrastructure of bases overseas has exploded in size and scope. Unknown to most Americans, Washington's garrisoning of the planet is on the rise thanks to a new generation of bases the military calls lily pads, as in a frog jumping across the pond towards its prey. These are small, secretive, inaccessible facilities with limited numbers of troops, Spartan amenities, and prepositioned weaponry and supplies. Those are the opening statements in this article from Professor David Vine. David Vine, some very powerful statements in this, and it pulls back the curtain on something I would like for you, sir, to take your time uninterrupted, as Ray McGovern was uninterrupted, and tell us about the type of bases we have, where are they, why do we have them, why do we need them, and what is the likely outcome if we don't stop and look at these and put all this in perspective, because at the other end of this, Dr. Vine, we have schools that are closing, teachers laid off, policemen laid off, firefighters laid off, libraries closing, health services diminishing, public services and utilities diminishing, 60% of the lights in Detroit at night turned off, 44 million Americans are homeless, who lost their homes, and another 40 million in the next 3 to 4 years are likely to go homeless. 18 million American children going to bed hungry each night because they don't have enough nutrition. 49 million Americans on food stamps. 100 million living at near or above the poverty level. Unions being busted. Quality of life diminished. And yet we have no limitation in spending money on these bases and their efforts. Could you explain this to us, sir?
I'll do my best. And maybe I'll start where you left us off and then move backwards to talk about what I see going on with bases. I think as the list you identified of all the needs here in the United States when it comes to housing and healthcare and education and transportation and infrastructure and on, I think that points to our need to redefine how we think about security and defense. And this is something that, you know, plenty of people have been talking about for quite some time. But we've defined security and defense so narrowly in terms of military defense. And of course, when we have this thing called the Department of Defense, that whose actions largely since 1947, as Ray McGovern was showing us, have not been defensive in nature. All too many of their actions and posture have been offensive in nature, beginning with an infrastructure of military bases located outside the United States, which today number easily over 1,000. So I think we need to rethink how we think about what it means to defend the United States and U.S. citizens, what it means to have security, to reorient security concerns to those needs that you outlined. And I think that begins with a major shift in priorities and spending. I think one of the really underappreciated effects of the U.S. response to the attacks of 9/11 has been to entrench these grossly inflated military budgets, beginning with the so-called Department of Defense, but as you pointed out earlier, extending to an entire national security bureaucracy that total spending for which easily exceeds $1 trillion a year. We need to rein that in, and as a very beginning point, go back to military spending levels that we saw at least in the Clinton administration rather than levels that easily equal those of the heights of the Cold War, when the threat, at least outside the United States, that exists, that the United States faces outside the United States pales in comparison to anything the United States conceivably confronted during the Cold War. We've essentially created a military budget totally out of proportion to any military threat that exists that the United States faces. All the while, these dramatic needs, these human security needs, that you pointed to here in the United States go wanting. One facet of that military budget, of course, is this infrastructure of military bases and troops, hundreds of thousands of troops that the United States maintains outside the 50 states and Washington, D.C. And in my article at TomDispatch.com, what I try to do is outline the ways in which that network of bases is changing and transforming in my mind. I used the description of the soldiers coming in to Ramstein Air Base as a jumping off point, because I was quite struck when medical personnel told me that they were seeing quite a few casualties from Africa. And indeed, that's not something we hear about in the media. That's not something that's being talked about. Why are there casualties coming from Africa? Most people in the United States don't even know that there is a substantial and growing military presence in Africa. And I think that conversation pointed to what is a pattern that I've been seeing developing since around 2000, since really before the attacks of 9/11, where the United States has been trying to, and the Pentagon in particular, need to be specific, trying to build as many relatively small military bases, often referred to as lily pads, in as many countries as possible as fast as it can. By my count, that total exceeds 50 of these relatively small lily pad bases constructed since around 2000. This doesn't mean that the United States is suddenly closing all the bases that have been in place since around World War II and the Korean War. The massive infrastructure of huge bases like Ramstein, like other bases, major American town-sized bases in places like Okinawa, elsewhere in Japan, in South Korea, in Italy. Many of those are still very much present. What's been going on is to some extent, some of those bases, especially in Germany, have been closed. They've been consolidating forces around a smaller number of large bases, many of which are expanding, bases like Ramstein, bases like some in South Korea and Japan. And at the same time, building these smaller bases, these lily pad bases. And the term lily pad refers to the idea of a frog jumping from lily pad to lily pad toward its prey. So the idea is to establish relatively small, isolated bases from which the United States, from which the U.S. military can rapidly project military power into any conflict that the Pentagon or the administration deems necessary to intervene in. Generally, these bases have relatively small numbers of troops. They don't have the amenities that you see at bases like Ramstein, where there's shopping and malls and housing developments for military personnel and family members and civilian contractors. Instead, these lily pad bases generally house a small number of troops, often special operations troops, as a trend you pointed to at the outset. Or private military contractors who run many of these lily pad bases. Some of these lily pad bases have drones, so they are critical to the drone wars. Some have pre-positioned supplies and equipment so that they could be linked with a larger number of troops coming from the United States or elsewhere and sort of catapulted, rushed into any conflict. So what I outline in my article is this pattern, the ways in which these bases are being built really on a global basis, Africa, Central America, Asia, the Persian Gulf even with a floating base, sometimes called the mothership, which is something of a dream for the military, to not have to answer to any local government at all, instead to be able to operate in international waters and project power that way, and in Europe as well. So we're seeing this global development of bases, and just, you know, look at one region. In Africa, we see bases created in places like Djibouti, Burkina Faso, Burundi, the Central African Republic, Ethiopia, Sao Tome and Principe, Senegal, Seychelles, and on and on. And that's just one continent. And I think there are many dangers of this strategy. Just one, for sake of time, I would point to is the chance that we are, and not just chance, we are getting involved in a number of local conflicts that people in the United States are little aware of, and even members of Congress have little oversight over, and we just don't know what the consequences are going to be of getting involved in these conflicts. And my fear is that, this is how I sort of end the article, my fear is that with our greater and greater involvement in these local and regional conflicts, with the help of these lily pad bases, that we will see, unfortunately, and sadly, more and more troops coming in from places like Africa, from places like Central America, Honduras, which you mentioned, places that are totally off the radar of the media and U.S. citizens generally.
I appreciate those insights. I have a overarching question for you, and just a little context. I'm concerned, as you are, about what happens when we go into a country where the population does not want us there, but the ruling elite or the industrialists or those who have the power do. They benefit. They're the ones who are frequently given bribes. And if you remember the man who wrote the book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins, talking about what he would do. He would go into a country, meet like in Honduras, in all over the world, and he would say, you have a choice. He would meet with the prime minister, the president, and he would say, work with us, and you'll be rewarded. Work against us, and you'll be killed. And indeed, he was a part of several operations where the person who worked against us was killed and assassinated, and he's confessed that. He went back to one of his countries where he was a part of that and talked about that and asked forgiveness for that. So now you take a look today. In Afghanistan, there is an 800-page report that was prepared by dozens of scholars and forensic experts who took a look at all of the death squads and the killings of Afghanistan civilians since the Russians left. And that means, the bottom line is, that there are hundreds of people in high power positions now in Afghanistan, including former warlords who controlled the poppy and controlled the sale of guns, who also made vast amounts of money by turning in prisoners, just normal people for the most part, and getting enormous bounties. And these were shipped off to Guantanamo and other places. And now they are, the vice president of Afghanistan is one of them. In fact, there are dozens in the current administration. So on the one hand, they're not being held accountable for crimes against humanity. The very crimes that we just put through the world court, we just put Taylor, Charles Taylor, in prison for life for, or some of the other war criminals. Not a single war criminal who caused the death directly or indirectly of tens of thousands of Afghanistans in mass graves, of which there are hundreds, not one is being pointed out, even though their names and testimony by people are in place. We, the United States government, under at that time Ronald Reagan, gave them the weapons, and gave them weapons through the covert war that was profiled by in Charlie Wilson's War, which was written by a former reporter at this 60 Minutes, Kreil, and whose sister Susan Kreil is a friend of mine, and she's an art scholar, and we were funding them. We were giving them munitions. We were training them. And we knew these were Islamic individuals, radical Islamics. We also knew that they were terrorists. We knew that they were capable of anything, but they were our allies and our assets. Now, they went ahead and committed all kinds, in the Northern Alliance, committed all kinds of crimes against humanity. But they were our assets, our tools. So now we're refusing to acknowledge complicity of the United States in what we did. We're refusing to bring any of them to justice, yet there's this 800-page report, which inevitably is going to be leaked to the world media in the next, I guess, the next couple of months. And then, why is that any different than us going into any other area of the world now and working with the ruling elite, working with the military, working with those who are what we're going to pay off and buy their allegiance to open up these bases, and if they've got problems, then we help them with their problems, so their problems then become our problems, and then we end up causing this negative impression on the citizens all over the world, as we have before. And I've documented this in a five-part series called Intervention in the Name of Peace, Democracy, and Freedom, what we actually did over 200 years in over 180 situations around the world, where we went in for peace, democracy, and freedom, and actually cause enormous suffering on the part of people in those countries. Do you see any of what I just said playing into your concerns?
Absolutely. And you outlined many of the concerns that I think we should all share. Many of these new bases that the United States has been creating over the past decade or so are located in countries with deeply problematic human rights records, with deeply undemocratic governments, You can see similar things, of course, going on in countries where we've had a presence for longer, like Bahrain, where we've been largely silent on the violent crackdown that the Bahraini government, with the help of the Saudi government, has been inflicting on democratic protesters there. But I'm deeply concerned that these bases, which are really part of a larger complex of tools that a number of people are now referring to as the new way of war that I think we're seeing developing under the Obama administration, with roots in the Bush administration, of course, but really accelerating in the Obama administration. There are a number of tools accompanying these lily pad bases, including deepening military-to-military ties between the U.S. military and local militaries, often ones, again, with fairly egregious human rights violations to their names, growing military training and exercises that the United States is orchestrating, all of which I think raise serious questions that need to be answered about why we're doing this. What are the effects of these strategies? My mind that they're likely to be ones that deeply undermine the security of the United States and U.S. citizens, not to mention the security of local peoples around the world, while elites benefit in ways that you mentioned, elites overseas and elites here in the United States.
One follow-up question, that Dr. Vine. Do you see China looking at how they could impact the United States foreign policy economically rather than militarily, because no one would win in a military campaign against China, it's not possible, or Russia, it's not possible, and I don't believe it is possible against Iran, because you're not dealing with a simple military situation. If we couldn't, after all these years in Afghanistan, stop the Taliban, as if we should have, and if we couldn't stop the violence in Iraq, imagine what we would be unleashing in Iran. So why doesn't, or do you believe that China is looking at what we're doing and thinking we're not going to play into their game and create another Cold War and, you know, and cause our own treasury to be depleted? What are your thoughts?
Well, I feel like I'm not enough of an expert on China or Chinese foreign policy to really comment on the Chinese approach. One might hope that is in the minds of some Chinese leaders, but I think we have to see this new way of war that the Obama administration has been building as an attempt, a fairly dramatic attempt and perhaps desperate attempt by the U.S. administration and U.S. leaders to hold on to the superpower status that the United States has maintained, either since the end of the Cold War or since the end of World War II, depending on one's perspective. It's an attempt to fend off the rising power of China. And I think it's a very dangerous strategy, as the power of the United States economically, politically, militarily wanes. It could generate really deadly consequences and a series of new conflicts in which the United States would be involved in.
Okay, fair enough. I have one final question for you based upon a quote from Chris Hedges. I'll ask you that in a few moments, but I want to go back to Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern, I'm going to ask you to address two countries, and I realize it's merely a subjective situation, but what do you see the outcome in Afghanistan, being that it's so utterly corrupt and tribal? What do you see the outcome in Iraq, equally corrupt and tribal? And do you see that everything that the neocons, including Petraeus and people like virtually all of the Paul Wolfowitz, and they didn't take into account one single person, that is Mukhtar Sadr. When he comes back at the end of 7 years, I think he's gone through five, where he has to finish all of his strict theological teachings where he can be considered a mullah, then he becomes the most powerful man in Iraq, because he will be heading the theocracy. And indeed, I see Iraq becoming very similar as Iran, as a theocracy with ruling councils and several different groups of governing boards, though they may have elections, may have a parliament. He will be the top person, and he isn't about to take anything that has been done up to this point in the United States. I could see him closing down the embassy, closing down all the bases, and saying, you're out of here, contractors, everything out of here. And if not, then you got the Sunni and the Sunni awakening with 100,000 people armed by the United States. You've got about 2,000 sheikhs who've been armed and funded. And then you have the Kurds, you got the Shia, and you've got the Sunni. You've got a triangulation of continuing conflict, unless it is separated out geographically. So I don't see any good thing happening in Iraq now or in the future. Your thoughts on both of these, please.
Pretty much been destroyed. The people that we would have least liked to come into prominence as the authorities, namely Shia leaders, more responsive to Iran than to anyone else, have seized power. The economy is a shambles except for the oil sector. Now, to the degree that our invasion had to do with oil, it's sort of a mixed bag. We've not been able to get the oil agreement that our companies wanted, but Iraq is now producing oil again, actually a substantial amount of oil. And so it remains to be seen whether the real people whose interests for which we fought are able to benefit from this. As for the people, with 2 million Iraqis, refugees outside their country, 2 million more refugees inside their country, largely because of the surge, the purpose of which was actually to change the city of Baghdad from a predominantly Sunni population to a predominantly Shia population. That's ethnic cleansing, and it was done with the cordon sanitaire that we created with our 30,000 extra troops. So Iraq is going to be a basket case for a long time to come. The corruption will not cease. The violence will not cease. I did hear yesterday that there were almost 70 fatalities in terrorist incidents in Iraq. Now, how about Afghanistan? Well, those of us who know anything about Vietnam or anything about insurgencies said from the beginning that this was a fool's errand. I mean, if you look into history, and you do need to know some history, starting with Alexander the Great, and you get the Persians, and then you get the Indians, and you got Genghis Khan, and they got the British, and then you got the Russians, and we, the United States, are we all powerful? Are we the ones that are going to be able to finally make the Afghans realize that they all have to get together and bow to our diktat? I don't think so. You know why they call Alexander the Great the Great? Well, my speculation is that when he got into Afghanistan, he had heard about the riches in China, okay? So his army's in Afghanistan, and they're taking considerable losses on their flanks from these people, these incorrigible people who for some reason don't like invaders coming into their country, okay? So he calls a little council of war, and they look around, and they look up at those mountains, and Alexander says, look, fellas, this doesn't seem to have been a very good idea. After all, let's get the hell back to Asia Minor where we know what we're doing, and he left, okay? Now, he was the only one to leave without substantial losses. The British lost tens of thousands of people, the Russians too. So what did we have? We had a green president coming in who knew very little about foreign policy, very, very much less about insurgencies, and the inertia or the vested interest of our military and the military-industrial complex persuaded this president that he couldn't politically, that after 9/11, it was unfeasible for him politically to, quote, lose Afghanistan, end quote. You know, it was a political problem. So what did he do? He let himself be persuaded to send in 20, 23,000 more troops, and then still more. As my colleague said, it's up to, or you, I guess you said, it's up to about 80, 90,000 now. He's going to withdraw those troops. And you know what the height of irony is? That these bemedaled generals, these folks like Petraeus, they forgot the basic things that we all learned at Army Infantry Officers School orientation in Benning, Fort Benning, which said that when you enter an operation, the first thing you do, whether it's a squad or a division or an army, is you make, sounds trite, an estimate of the situation, okay? The enemy, how many are there? Where are they? What's the weather like? What's the terrain like? And not least, the locks. Okay, now I'm from New York City, and I'm talking about locks and bagels. I'm talking about lines of communication and supply. Without having secure lines of communication and supply, no infantry officer worth his salt or squad leader worth their salt would commit troops to battle. Okay, now, what are our lines of communication and supply? Well, they start with a ship in San Francisco, let's say. It goes to Karachi after several weeks. In Karachi, it offloads, and it goes the length and breadth of Pakistan, over the Hindu Kush, the highest mountains in the world, down into Afghanistan, where one result, of course, is that a gallon of gasoline going into a tank there costs about $800 by the time it gets there. Worse still, those lines of communication and supply are cut-offable, as we have seen. The Pakistanis cut it off in November of last year, and just this past month reopened it. They're getting attacked by all kinds of, quote, insurgents, end quote. So the irony here is that we're really hell-bent on reopening those lines of communication and supply, not to resupply our troops, but to get the heck out of there. We want to be able to get our tanks out of Afghanistan. We can't get them through Central Asia. That costs too much and is too difficult. So we need those lines of communication and supply. What I'm saying here is that this war was a feckless effort from the beginning. Nobody, well, they knew these things, but the Petraeuses and so forth, but they succumbed to this temptation when the president says, can you do this? Yes, sir, of course we can do this. And they knew they couldn't. Witness the fact that Petraeus from very early on said, this is not going to be winnable militarily. And he was dead right about that. And people ought to know that. Last thing I'll say is that when I hear people saying, well, you know, are some people from our neighborhood, the sons of them, have fallen in battle. Well, they haven't fallen in battle. They haven't fallen. They have been sacrificed. They have been sacrificed for the mighty dollar that comes to the corporations that are profiteering on these wars, and for the political convenience of a president who doesn't have the guts to stand up and say, this is crazy, I'm withdrawing the troops now, and we're going to talk. The way these things end is by talking. The way Vietnam ended, we went to Paris and we talked to the Vietnamese. What needs to happen is the people who have a share in the interests there in Afghanistan need to get together under the auspices of those people and figure it out. They can figure it out. They have more stake in Afghanistan than we do. We need to withdraw. It's a fool's errand, and of course the tragedy is that when we talk about 2,000-3,000 U.S. soldiers killed, how many more maimed? And, you know, Afghans are people too. How many tens of thousands of people have perished in this godforsaken war?
I appreciate those insights, Ray McGovern. Last year, I watched a documentary, and in one scene of the documentary, there's a Afghanistan father whose wife has died. He has four or five children. It's the winter time. It's snowing out. One of the children has no shoes. The father's trying to sell the child. He doesn't want to sell his daughter, but he says he has no choice because he can't feed her. The children hadn't eaten in 3 days. And he said she will die from the weather or lack of food. He said, I cannot feed them. I cannot house them. I have no clothes. I have nothing for them because of this war. And then the postscript said that all the children in that video died within the month. And for those of us who care about the casualties, all the casualties in all conflicts, the 500,000 that Madeleine Albright, Hillary, and Bill Clinton allowed to be sacrificed when we intentionally blew up the power stations and the water purification stations against, by the way, against the Geneva Convention and a war crime in the first conflict against Saddam Hussein, thinking the people would rebel when their children started to die. Well, 500,000 children died, and no one seems to realize what would it mean if 500,000 American children died because of what someone did to us. And then 1 million people have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, civilians. That's the lowest figure I can come up with that's authentic. And according to Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist from Columbia University, he estimates that the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts and post-conflict care for the soldiers and all and reconstruction will cost us about $6 trillion. Trillion. And yet we don't have universal health care in the United States. My final comments are those of Chris Hedges. And I would like for you to both take a moment at the completion of this commentary and give your thoughts, and then we will complete our program. This is called The Careerist. And I share this with you for a simple reason. Because there are times when we ask, how is it possible that we could be spending so much money in anything we do, in these bureaucracies, when we hear about a coffee urn in an airplane going for $20,000 or, you know, a $400 hammer through a military contractor? And why aren't people standing up and saying, this is crazy, let's stop doing it? Well, the greatest crimes of human history are made possible by the most colorless human beings. According to Chris, they are the careerists, the bureaucrats, the cynics. They do the little chores that make vast, complicated systems of exploitation and death a reality. They collect and read the personal data gathered on tens of millions of us by the security and surveillance state. They keep the accounts of ExxonMobil and British Petroleum and Goldman Sachs. They build or pilot aerial drones. They work in corporate advertising and in public relations. They issue the forms. They process the papers. They deny food stamps to some and unemployment benefits or medical coverage to others. They enforce the laws and the regulations, and they do not ask questions. Good, evil, these words do not mean anything to them. They are beyond morality. They are there to make corporate systems function. If insurance companies abandon tens of millions of sick to suffer and die, so be it. If banks and sheriff departments toss families out of their homes, so be it. If financial firms rob citizens of their savings, so be it. If the government shuts down schools and libraries, so be it. If the military murders children in Pakistan and Afghanistan, so be it. If commodity speculators drive up the cost of rice and corn and wheat so that they are unaffordable for hundreds of millions of poor across the planet, so be it. If Congress and the courts strip citizens of basic civil liberties, so be it. If the fossil fuel industry turns the earth into a broiler of greenhouse gases that doom us, so be it. They serve the system, the god of profit and exploitation. The most dangerous force in the industrialized world does not come from those that wield radical creeds, whether Islamic radicalism or Christian fundamentalism, but from legions of faceless, feckless bureaucrats who claw their way up layered corporate and government machines. They serve any system that meets their pathetic quota of needs. These system managers believe nothing. They have no loyalty. They are rootless. They do not think beyond their tiny, insignificant roles. They are blind and deaf. They are, at least regarding the great ideas and patterns of human civilization and history, utterly illiterate. And we turn them out of universities. We turn out the lawyers, the technocrats, the business majors, the financial managers, the IT specialists, the consultants, the petroleum engineers, the communications majors, the cadets, the sales representatives, the computer programmers, men and women who know no history, no ideas. They live and think in an intellectual vacuum, a world of stultifying minutia. They are the T.S. Eliots, the hollow men, the stuffed men. Your thoughts, because without these hollow men and women in the military-industrial complex, and its $1.4 trillion budget each year, that neither the Republicans nor Democrats are willing to challenge or touch, and the only provision was one to reduce some future funding above a certain level, but it continues to increase in real dollars with no accountability whatsoever, with tens of billions of dollars simply missing, and yet all this goes forward everywhere around the world with these bureaucrats continuing to function and no moral equation used in the process. Your final thoughts, Professor David Vine?
It's a big question, and I haven't read the article, but it sounds like I need to. It sounds like there is some very useful and important analysis there. On the whole, though, I'm a bit concerned. It sounds like Hedges is suggesting there's this group of evil people. He says they're beyond morality, but it sounds like the article is painting them as essentially evil, that are perpetuating the system and making exploitation possible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When I think at other points in what you read, for me, he's on to something a little bit more useful. He talks about we churning them out. He talks about the system. Because I think we can't just say it's the problem of this group over here, of bureaucrats, these people. It doesn't seem very useful to me when I think we are all part of the system, you know, beginning with our tax dollars that are funding the wars we've been discussing, that have been funding the deaths that we've mentioned, that have funded the tragedies in Iraq and Afghanistan and well beyond. But in smaller ways, so many of us are connected to this system, to the military-industrial complex, and to a larger capitalist system that churns out exploitation, that churns out people like the ones that Hedges is describing. And I think that is what needs to change. And I think one of the ways, in my mind, that it's very difficult to think about how do we take on the entrenched power of the military-industrial complex. Very difficult task, a complex that's grown only more powerful, I would say, in the past decade and more since the attacks of 9/11. I think in a way this is pessimistic and optimistic at the same time, because I think we can take on that power. I do think at the same time that the Lockheed Martins of the world, the Boeings, are in a certain sense too powerful, too well entrenched, too interconnected with politicians who do their bidding. So that I think, you know, trying to eliminate them entirely would be a fool's errand, and that instead we have to think about ways in which we can convert the arms manufacturers, convert the elements of the military-industrial complex into other industries, into ones that will begin to address the human security needs that we've been talking about, beginning with green energy and other major infrastructure projects. That's one direction that I see some people working on, focused on conversion, the conversion of arms manufacturers into other industries. But I do think we need to think about the whole system rather than just sort of casting aspersions on a group of people, when we have to remember the people who are involved in these bureaucracies, they are doing it because they get a paycheck at the end of the day, I think, because they need to make a living in this capitalist society that we all live in, that they need to feed families. And until we create other ways to survive, you're going to see people taking up these jobs, not questioning the orders they're given. Power of the paycheck is a very powerful one. And so rather than seeing these individuals as evil, I think we need to take a look at the system that's paying them to do the work they're doing on a daily basis.
Thank you. I appreciate those insights. Ray McGovern, your thoughts on this and your solutions that you would offer us.
Well, Gary, this is a lot to think about and discuss, but let me offer some thoughts. I'm thinking about what you said about that poor Afghan father and his children. I have 5 children and 8 grandchildren. I can't fathom what that would be like, okay? And I think the clue, the key to all this, is that one must have some direct personal experience with innocent suffering. Once one is personally acquainted with that, then one has a decent chance of reflecting on what moral behavior is really like and making judgments with respect to what needs to happen, what do I need to do. I would suggest that most of these people, the bureaucrats that Chris Hedges talks about, and the people way up the line, up to and including the President of the United States and the lion's share of his advisors, have had no experience at all with real innocent suffering, such as the kind of suffering you described there before. And that's one of the major problems as I see it. Now, what can we do about that? Well, one thing we can do is reach out to the people who are suffering in this country, to reach out to them and say, this need not be. I see great hope in the in the Occupy movement. I think Chris Hedges is right in saying we need to write articles and we need to think things through, but we also need to be willing to put our bodies into it, as Martin Luther King Jr. said. We need to expose what's going on, and then we need to act. And I've been arrested with Chris Hedges, and it was one of the more poignant arrests on a wintry day here in Washington. What I'm suggesting is this, that number one, we need to make sure that our colleagues, our co-citizens here, are aware that when they pay their income taxes, more than half of that goes to our offense department, okay? I think my colleague described it, well, this is not about defense anymore. It's about offense, and it's about greasing the pockets of the military-industrial complex. That needs to be brought out. That evil, the evil that Dr. King actually exposed, I remember one section of that incredible letter from the Birmingham City Jail. He's talking about a boil, okay? Now, those of you who suffered these when through adolescence, you know what a boil is like. He says, like a boil that can never be cured so long as it's covered up, but must be uncovered with all its pus-flowing ugliness to the natural lights, to the natural medicines of air and light, so too injustice. Injustice can never be healed until it is exposed with all the tensions that exposure creates to the air of national opinion and the light of human conscience before it can be cured. That needs to happen. That's what I spend 20 hours a day trying to do, write and speak and let people know what's going on. The other thing is that I'm a former Army officer, okay? And that means that I, like millions of others, took a solemn oath. Now, that oath did not have to do with loyalty to the president, this or that president. That oath had to do with the Constitution. That oath had to do with pledging to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, I've checked into that, and that oath has no expiration date. And I've been talking with colleagues from the military and high government office and saying, that being the case, my friends, that being the case that we swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, what is our proper attitude? What is our requirement or our duty at this point? When we see the highest officials of our country deliberately, openly violating the Bill of Rights, for example, and bragging about it, where does a president get off bragging about killing American citizens without due process? Where are the lawyers in this country that seem to acquiesce in the president saying, well, or Brennan, his sidekick, that we do due process in the White House. The Constitution doesn't say judicial process. It says due process, and so we do the due process here. Well, give me a break. There should be an outcry. And you know what? When I see the National Defense Authorization Act and the draconian measures that allow the president or the FBI or Homeland Security to come into this office right here where I speak, pluck me and put me in Guantanamo without due process, okay? When I see that happen, I say, what are they thinking? And you know what I think? I think they're afraid. It's the only way I can explain. Why did the president sign that bill at 10 o'clock on New Year's Eve? So we wouldn't notice. Well, we've noticed. And what that means is that they are afraid of us. And this fall, if we have 80,000 people surrounding the Congress and the White House in Washington, who are they going to call on? Well, the Park Police? No, I don't think so. The Park Police have been very, very, very amicable toward us, we occupiers on Freedom Plaza. Oh, how about the district police? Uh-uh. The district police are beginning to realize that they are part of the 99%. Oh, okay, the Capitol Police. They're not much good for anything except working those machines to get you into the Capitol building. Ah, the Secret Service. There aren't enough of Secret Service folks, and some of them are in Cartagena. So who are they going to call on? The U.S. Army. And to do that, they had to reverse 140 years of judicial history in this country, reverse the Posse Comitatus Act after World War, after the Civil War, and allow them to call upon the Army to come into this office of mine, pluck us out, put us in Guantanamo without any due process. That's what they're afraid of. That's the way they can get the Army, which they can depend on, to follow orders, because those poor kids from the inner city, and most of them from the inner city or for towns of this country of less than 50,000 people, they will follow orders, okay? And when Petraeus and the rest of them, or the generals now, say, look, round up these folks. Okay, there are 80,000 of them, but we got places to put them. They want to be able to depend on a dependable outfit, and that's the U.S. Army. That's how afraid they are. Bottom line, we need to read Gandhi, and we need to be humble, but we need to be straightforward. We need to create mass demonstrations of civil disobedience, such that if there won't be enough prisons to put us all in. And once the American people realize that they're being had, that we are the 99%, and that people who are making tons of money need to pay their share, I think things can change. But it's going to take a while, and it's going to take a lot more guts than any of us have exhibited, including me, up till now.
Ray McGovern, Army intelligence officer, CIA analyst for JFK and other administrations, website raymcgovern.com, and also consortiumnews.com. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate your insights.
You're most welcome.
Also, degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University and Harvard Business School and Georgetown University. Professor David Vine, professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, author of Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base at Diego Garcia, and davidvine.net. Thank you very much for being with us. I certainly appreciate your insights.
Thanks so much, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. That concludes an extended version, an hour and 50 minutes on the Progressive Commentary Hour. You can download any of the programs to listen again. Have a nice day, everyone.